From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Callum Borchers. It's Here and Now. The Biden administration is now promising enough COVID-19 vaccines for every adult by the end of May, 2 months ahead of expectations. And as part of that effort, the president announced a collaboration between two competitors. Merck will help produce the newly authorized Johnson & Johnson shot. So how will that work? Brooke Baker is a professor at Northeastern University School of Law with a focus on intellectual property and access to medicine. He joins us on Skype. Professor, welcome.
Good to be here. Thanks for asking me.
So the Biden administration said Johnson & Johnson has been falling behind in manufacturing, and so that's where Merck's production capabilities come in. How important could this partnership be for increasing supply, and how will it work with rivals suddenly cooperating?
Well, I think it's a very significant step forward, though, you know, not enough, but a good step forward to put U.S. dollars to work and for a major vaccine manufacturer to repurpose its facilities to make a more successful vaccine candidate. So Merck has not yet announced how much vaccine it hopes to make of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, but it certainly will be in the hundreds of millions of doses we would expect and will come online later in the year. It'll take a little while to change over the manufacturing facilities and to achieve regulatory approval, but then literally tens and hundreds of millions of doses may be available towards the end of the year. They may be available for use in the U.S., but hopefully they'll be made available for countries around the world, which, as most of your listeners will know, have far less access to effective COVID vaccines than we in rich countries, especially the U.S.
Yes, so there's a long-term play here. But this, of course, wouldn't have been Merck's first choice. They had their own vaccine candidate that was not successful. So why would Merck agree to this? I mean, what does the company get in return?
One, it's the investment is being borne by the U.S., so there's little out-of-pocket cost to Merck, and of course, it will get compensated for vaccine sales. It also is a reputational boost, but you know, a more cynical view is that the major big pharma companies are trying to control global supply within their existing cartel. And not really to cooperate with a broader base demand that's been made by developing countries in particular and by the WHO, that there be significant investments to expand manufacturing capacity and use existing manufacturing capacity in low and middle income countries.
Well, let me ask you to expand on that point. And as you use the word cartel, that's sort of strong language. And you wrote in a blog post for the Health Global Access Project, which is an advocacy group, that these companies shouldn't be viewed as liberators because they're actually refusing to share their vaccine technologies and know-how with other countries, even if they are cooperating on manufacturing. And you say that's going to cause the pandemic to drag on. Explain what you mean.
Well, these vaccine candidates were, for all intents and purposes, started a year ago, right? And there was very quick sharing of genomic information on COVID-19 that allowed vaccine manufacturers to get a huge jump start last winter and spring. And way last year, the WHO established something called the COVID-19 Technology Access Pool to get vaccine manufacturers and medicines manufacturers and diagnostic manufacturers to basically pool their technology so that we could begin to scale up manufacturing capacity as quickly as possible. Not a single company, and certainly not a single vaccine company, has put one iota of its technology into that pool yet.
Could the president then, Professor, do more under the Defense Production Act on that front? We do see the president invoking this Korean War era law to some degree. He's going to give Merck priority for equipment and materials to manufacture these J&J vaccines. The prior administration got some criticism for not using the DPA enough during the pandemic. So is the president using the law to its full capacity?
Could he compel them
to share intellectual property?
Yes, it is a positive step to expand manufacturing capacity and particularly to repurpose some of the existing capacity. But there is more that could be done. There is spare capacity and capacity that should be brought on board in other countries and in other regions. So I think the president could go a couple steps further. He could make it clear to drug companies that they have to share the recipes to allow producers in other regions to come on board. That production will need some financing. It's actually possible under the Defense Production Act not just to build manufacturing supply capacity in the U.S., but also to do so abroad. So this would mean President Biden actually bringing the drug companies into the Oval Office and banging heads a little bit and said, we've got to share these recipes globally. They have entered into agreements with some other major contract manufacturers like Serum Institute in India, which is the largest vaccine manufacturer in the world. But there's lots of other capacity that is underutilized at present that could be repurposed or even greenfield built if needed to prepare us for the next phases of this pandemic and also for future pandemics as well.
Brooke Baker is a professor at Northeastern University School of Law with a focus on intellectual property and access to medicine. Professor, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The CDC reports that more than 51 million people in America have received at least one dose of the vaccine, but a lot of Americans are still hesitant. A poll out last month from the Kaiser Family Foundation found that 31% of respondents say they'll wait and see how the vaccine is working. Well, some high school students in Denver are trying to encourage people to get the shot. Colorado Public Radio's Jenny Brundine tells us how they're doing it.
High school teacher Eric Dinkle is passionate about science. He's equally passionate, he tells his students, about something else.
So I think this is a really important part of science. If we don't do anything with our knowledge, what's the point of knowing it, right?
So his students dreamed up a project to translate to others their understanding of how the COVID-19 vaccine works. They thought, why not make videos targeting those who are unsure about getting the vaccine?
The testing process for the BNT162b2 vaccine was
not people opposed to taking the vaccine, but those on the fence. Even student Mateo Ferrol Carate's own parents were unsure. His group took on suspicions about how fast the vaccine was developed. He pored over medical journals and discovered the vaccine faced the same rigorous regulatory hurdles as other vaccines.
The people who made the vaccine took the vaccine, so it really makes this confidence that if they're willing to take it themselves, I have no reason not to trust them. They're not going to throw their own lives away.
In fact, when medical professionals took the vaccine, that's what won over Mateo's parents. In studies, Mateo read about how each trial participant was monitored and how any kind of atypical reaction was tracked.
Did this abnormality happen because of our vaccine or because of just another environmental source?
Ryan Straub's group found abnormal reactions, like allergic reactions, are extremely rare.
As of January 11th, it was only 29 people.
Classmate Beth Elder says the message they'd like to get across in their video is to stay with a health provider at least 15 minutes after the shot.
And if you're going to a pop-up clinic that isn't prepared to deal with you like that, or a drive-up that you leave before that 15 minutes is up, it can just get really dangerous if they're not monitoring it more.
Another classmate, Grace McElhaney, is ready to bring her newfound knowledge to her own grandmother, who's skeptical of the vaccine.
She is a stubborn woman, so we'll see. But I think if I bring in the science, she'll have to listen.
Before his students started their projects, teacher Eric Dinkle says the class discussed...
Well, what's it like to have a conversation with someone who thinks different than you?
The class identified the first quality you need to begin to understand how someone else feels is empathy. As Dinkle circulates the room, he reminds students of that.
Our goal is not to alienate or belittle. Our goal is to recognize that people's concerns are really valid and they're rational. And so that your mission as scientists is to offer them an accessible way, entertaining way, evidence that helps them consider a different point of view.
The students say they can understand why there are so many myths and misconceptions about the vaccine. It's new science.
Let's see. So we have how the cells break down and get rid of the mRNA.
And it can be complex.
We have what mRNA is, how it creates antigens.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says messenger RNA vaccines are a new type of vaccine that teaches our cells how to make a protein that activates an immune response. Hayden Wright says his group is tackling the spooky myth that mRNA will alter people's DNA.
We have to explain that the mRNA doesn't actually affect the area that DNA is. It's in, like, the layer outside of it.
Two boys in another group have a powerful argument for getting the vaccine, one that resonates especially for teenagers. If herd immunity isn't established and people have to keep quarantining, mental health will keep getting worse. Here's Sincere Milligan-Pate, followed by Ian Zonka.
No one's really paying attention to what's going on behind the scenes and what's going on in people's heads.
Yeah, we feel that's more important. Like, mental health could, like, be more catastrophic than a possible side effect of the vaccine, we believe.
One recent study of high school students found that nearly a third reported feeling unhappy or depressed. It said teens are experiencing a collective trauma. Meantime, a couple of other students have an explosive idea. Their video is a spoof on the 1987 public service announcement, Your Brain on Drugs. Their experiment involves dry ice, warm water, and a lot of ping pong balls and safety glasses.
Using the Pfizer vaccine with an R-naught value of 5.7, the equation yields...
The idea is if people don't get the vaccine, the coronavirus will spread through the population like exploding ping pong balls. For Here and Now, I'm Jenny Brendine in Denver.
Tomorrow is an important date for a powerful QAnon conspiracy. That former President Donald Trump will make a triumphant return on March 4th to be sworn in for a second term, replacing President Biden, whose inauguration, as the story goes, was a Hollywood-produced fake. While it may be among the most delusional of QAnon beliefs, it's one that's gaining traction and causing concern. In this report that first aired on Tuesday's All Things Considered, NPR's Tovia Smith looks at how such fallacies are gripping Americans and efforts to combat them.
Conspiracy theories go way back. Flat earthers have been around almost as long as the Earth. But now experts say they're spinning out on an unprecedented scale. Like the big lie, the baseless claim that Trump won the election and President Biden did not.
Mm-mm. No way. It was rigged. Everything was rigged.
Michelle Queen, a 46-year-old from Texas, is one of a quarter of Americans, according to a recent Ipsos poll, who believe those false claims of election fraud. And she's among the 20% who believe that those who broke into the Capitol in January were actually undercover members of the left-wing Antifa, even though most of those arrested have been affiliated with right-wing groups.
That's who they said they arrested. They didn't tell you all the others. You know, the news ain't going to give you the whole thing.
While Queen does not consider herself part of QAnon, she also believes some of its most outlandish tenets. For example, that Satan-worshipping elites in a secret pedophile cabal are killing babies and drinking their blood.
When you are evil, you're evil. It goes deep.
The Ipsos poll shows a close correlation between those who believe in conspiracies and those who get most their news from conservative news sources, social media, or apps like Parler and Telegram that have become disinformation super spreaders. Experts see it as a public health emergency, threatening democracy, straining family relationships, and now also straining an industry of folks trying to help.
I've probably got almost 100 requests in my inbox.
Diane Benscoter has been helping people untangle from extremist ideologies since the 80s, after she was extricated from the Unification Church, commonly known as the Moonies. She recently founded a nonprofit called Antidote to run Al-Anon-style recovery groups for those caught up in disinformation and their loved ones. Anyone can be drawn in, she says, as cultic groups all tend to fill some psychological void.
It establishes this camaraderie and this feeling of righteousness and this cause for your life. And that feels very invigorating and almost addictive. You feel like you are fighting the battle for goodness. And all of a sudden, you feel like you are the hero.
In other cases, the draw is what Benscoter calls easy answers to life's hard questions. That's what got 32-year-old Jay Gilley, a pizza delivery guy from Alabama who spent 3 years caught up in QAnon. It started when he questioned the Black Lives Matter movement and got criticized online. One click led to another, and he wound up deep into dark conspiracies and hate speech dressed up as dogma, which to Gilley felt like validation.
Just having someone tell you you're right and don't listen to people, it just leads you down that path so fast. You want to be right so bad. You didn't want to be drugged back into that confusion.
Eventually, thanks to a patient friend, Gilley came to understand how he, a left-leaning Obama supporter, allowed himself, as he puts it, to fall down a far-right rabbit hole.
Looking back at now, it's terrifying. Like, this is like a war on thought. Like, are we just going to start fighting for just thought control?
For all the psyops used to suck people into a cultic group, experts say it takes just as much savvy and precision to help them out. Pat Ryan, another former cult member turned deprogrammer or exit counselor, says when a family hires him to meet with a loved one, his first step is to do a kind of intervention on the family. He implores them to change their tone, to be less adversarial or less mocking. It's not only because that's counterproductive, Ryan says, but also, if he gets the family to back off a bit, he scores instant points with the loved one he's ultimately trying to reach.
It's strategic. Oh, absolutely. We're talking strategy, because if I can get a family to do something meaningful, then I have credibility. And so then we have a path to go on.
Of course, it's much easier said than done. Many are adamant, like Michelle Queen, that no one could change their mind. But Queen was willing to sit down with Ben Scoter just to hear her out.
Hi, Michelle.
Hello.
Hi.
Ben Scoter begins gently, asking how Queen's faring in the aftermath of last month's Texas snowstorm.
Are you okay as far as electricity and or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. Right now, we're good. Mm-hmm.
Oh, good.
Then Ben Scoter walks a fine line, being totally upfront that she wants Queen to consider that she's caught in a web of disinformation while insisting that she's not trying to turn Queen into a Democrat, for example.
That is not what I'm about, even a little.
And then Ben Scoter carefully starts making the case that anyone can be duped, offering up herself as Exhibit A and explaining how she, as a Mooney, thought she was following the Messiah.
You know, that sounds outrageous, but, you know, I wasn't stupid, and one thing led to another, and it kind of fed into some fears I had, and it just...
Queen listens quietly as Ben Scoter continues, explaining how the indoctrination tactics worked on her.
I started believing that all information from regular news sources is just wrong. And they became like the enemy.
But a few minutes in, Queen starts to push back.
I pray on everything. I'm not in a cult. Mm-mm.
It'd be the first of many times that Ben Scoter would back off and pivot in search of even the tiniest patch of common ground.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I think is so sad right now is that the country has been so divided and people almost are like spitting at each other. And that's just not what this country should be, I don't think.
Right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
Before long, they find more they can agree on, that January's violence at the U.S. Capitol was wrong, and so is hurting children, even though they disagree on what's actually happening.
Some of the things that are being spread about, you know, babies being eaten and things, I don't think those things are true personally.
I
know you do, and I think we need to get to the bottom of that, though.
Now, how would we do that?
Ben Scoter talks about the reputable nonprofits fighting human trafficking and suggests Queen get involved. It's all about planting seeds of doubt and building rapport.
I think now is the time to start building bridges.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And sturdy bridges, not nothing that's going to fall apart.
Yes, I'm with you there.
By the end, they agree to keep talking, just what Ben Scoter was hoping for.
It may seem like you're being tricky or crafty, but really what you're doing is respecting the fact that this is not going to be an easy process for them to get out of this with their dignity.
It's a tedious and time-intensive process, too, that can't keep up with disinformation spreading virally online. Ben Scoter says the only viable strategy is prevention, and she's helping develop a public awareness campaign to keep people from falling down the rabbit hole in the first place.
I think it's really important to try to help people inoculate, to try to create herd immunity to psychological manipulation and to hit that tipping point in society where more people understand how these tactics work, and those who try to use them will be less successful using them because they're easily spotted now.
Other experts liken the threat of disinformation to secondhand smoke. We used to think smokers were only harming themselves. When we started to know better, we started doing more to combat it. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
NPR's Tovia Smith with some additional reporting from NPR's Joel Rose and Sarah McCammon. You can find our series on disinformation at npr.org.
As we near the anniversary of pandemic lockdowns, we've been following how people around the world have tried to stave off the isolation that comes with being stuck at home. Well, in lieu of travel, some have been tuning in to Tree.fm, a website that serves up recordings of forests around the world, like this one from Denali National Park in Alaska. Tree.fm is the work of Kai Nikolaitis, a web developer based in Berlin. The recordings come from the crowdsourced Sounds of the Forest project in the UK. Nikolaitis says they've had millions of visitors since launching last year.
It's like virtual travel or some home office escape tool or digital Shinrin Yoku. It's a Japanese term for, you know, forest bathing.
They partnered with the website Ecosia to get visitors to fund reforestation efforts around the world. But users just seeking an escape can click a button that says, listen to a random forest, and find themselves bird watching in Fukushima, Japan, or imagining themselves in Germany's Black Forest. Nikolaitis' personal favorite is from a national park in Malaysia that he visited before the pandemic. Germany plans to ease some of its pandemic restrictions next week, but at least until then, Nikolaitis says he'll keep digital forest bathing while sipping his morning coffee.
Yeah, the only sounds I'm hearing is, you know, like maybe some podcast from A to B or traffic or, you know, like my baby's crying, you know, like this is the sound that I'm hearing day in, day out. And so this is just refreshing.
And he's not the only one in his household who enjoys it. His baby, Ani, does too.
Also with my tiny daughter, she really reacts to rain. If you play rain to her, she just easily falls asleep. So I think there's something in our brains hardwired that just relaxes us when we listen to just those natural sounds, you know, like the things that we came from, basically, you know, and not artificial things that we surround ourselves with now.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
The news is about more than what just happened. You need to know why it happened, who made it happen, how it's felt in the communities you care about. NPR's daily news podcast, Consider This, gives you all of that, with context, backstory, and analysis on a single topic every weekday. It's not just information, it's what the news means. Consider This from NPR.
Senator Tim Kaine wants Congress to reassert its war powers. He reintroduced legislation today to repeal measures passed in 1991 and 2002 that authorized the use of military force against Iraq. These are known as AUMFs, and presidents have used them to justify American military action around the world. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia, joins us now. Senator, welcome.
Callan, great to be with you today.
Glad to have you. And Senator, I know you were frustrated that Congress didn't get advance notice before President Biden approved the airstrikes on Iranian militia targets in Syria last week. Would your bill force the president to do that next time?
This bill would not, Callum, but it's part of a three-step process that I envision working on these issues with a growing group of bipartisan senators. So the bill we're introducing today, with eight sponsors, four Democrats and four Republicans, would take the two Iraq War authorizations, the first Gulf War and then the 02 Iraq resolution, and repeal them, because Iraq is now not an enemy. Iraq is a partner of ours. And so why have these authorizations floating out there that can be used to create mischief? Congress needs to show it can't just initiate war. Congress also needs to show that it can stop a war. So that's step one. Step two is to think about rewriting the 2001 authorization that allows military action against non-state terrorist groups like these Iranian-backed militias that aren't part of the Iraqi government. They have more loyalty to Iran. and they're non-state terrorist groups, but they don't easily fit within the 2001 authorization. And then step three, frankly, is to rewrite the War Powers Act from 1974, which is proven unworkable in many ways. The goal should be that we shouldn't get into these back and forth conflicts on a presidential say-so, whoever the president is, without consultation and often approval from Congress.
I see. Okay, so taking that point, but let me just ask the counter that I'm sure you've heard before, which is that, you know, there was a rocket attack today on a base that hosts U.S.-led coalition troops in Iraq, and Iran hit this same base with missiles last year, injuring dozens of American troops. So if we're under attack, Senator, shouldn't the president have the authority to respond quickly?
And Callum, yes, and no one is proposing to get rid of that, but I'm going to use this recent example to show you why I think this is needed. Presidents do have the ability to defend the United States from ongoing attack or imminent attack. But here's what's happening with Iran. After the President Trump blew up the diplomatic deal with Iran, there's just been this back and forth series of provocations. President Trump killing Iranian leaders, Iranian militias then striking air bases, and then we do something and they do something, all without a discussion in Congress. If we're going to be in a war, I think the American public, and especially our troops, deserve that we have a discussion. What's at stake? Is it in our interest, for example, to be in another war in the Middle East? And if the answer is yes, then let Congress have the backbone to vote that we should. But if you allow a president to undertake unilateral action, then there will be a response, and then the president will need to respond, and then there will be another response. So you're right. I mean, we struck Iranian positions Thursday night. At the time of that strike, the U.S. had a diplomatic offer on the table to Iran to rejoin discussions to look for a potential path forward to denuclearize. Iran was considering that diplomatic offer.
We didn't quite get there. Senator, I'm sorry to cut you off there. We are going to have to leave the conversation there. Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat of Virginia, thank you for your time.
You bet.
As we've been reporting, President Biden says we should have enough vaccine doses by the end of May to cover every adult in this country. And we're learning more about the third vaccine on the market, the single-dose option of Johnson & Johnson. But we put a call out to you to find out your most pressing questions about the vaccines on the market. And we'll start with some of the most common ones we received. And with us to answer some of them is Dr. Ruth Caron. She's a professor of international health in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. She's also the director for the Center of Immunization Research. And Dr. Caron, welcome.
Good afternoon, Tanya. It's great to be with you.
Yes, it's great to have you. We received more than two dozen questions from our audience, and we'll get to as many as we can in this conversation and on our website hereandnow.org. One common question we continue to receive is about the vaccine in pregnant women. As we've reported, pregnant women were not part of the clinical trials. The WHO and the CDC recommends pregnant women check with their doctors before receiving it. And here's a question from listener Key of Singapore, who is 3 weeks pregnant. She asks, I received the first and second dose on January 24th and February 14th, respectively. I discovered I'm about 3 weeks pregnant. I would like to know if there has been any adverse effects of the vaccine at such an early stage of pregnancy. Doctor?
Yes. So as you said, Tanya, there haven't yet been trials of either the Pfizer-BioNTech or the Moderna vaccines in pregnant women, although Pfizer is just now beginning a 4,000-person study in pregnant women in the U.S. and several countries in Europe and Africa. Having said that, there were some women who were pregnant, didn't perhaps know they were pregnant, who were enrolled in the Pfizer trial. There were about 12 of those women. And we don't know of any adverse effects. What I would actually suggest to this, I didn't know this individual was in Singapore, and I hope that they have a similar process in Singapore. Here in the U.S., pregnant women who receive vaccine can register through the VSafe registry at the CDC. And we would encourage every pregnant woman who gets COVID vaccine to participate in that registry. That's a way that we will be able to get real-world evidence of how this vaccine works in pregnant women, in addition to the trial that Pfizer is just beginning now.
Oh, this is wonderful information, and we'll have more information on that CDC registry at our website. Thank you so much for that. Another question we've been getting is about the side effects of the vaccine. This one is from Jessica Tong of Niceville, Florida, and she wants to know, what happens to your muscle cells that express the spike protein after receiving the COVID vaccination? What happens to the spike protein over time that is on muscle cell surfaces?
So most of what we know about this, we know from some animal studies that were done of these vaccines before they were given to humans. And what we can say is that probably the spike protein stays on your muscle cells for about a week or two. It also actually goes into your lymph nodes in your armpit, underneath, which is good because that's where a lot of the antibody-producing cells are made. And then it's metabolized. The muscle cells don't break down from that specifically. They do over time. You know, muscle cells are cells that die and are regenerated, but that's what happens to that spike protein. It's not there forever and ever. It's there for probably a finite period of time.
We're learning so much about our bodies and how our bodies work through all of this. Right now, the COVID vaccines are for people 16 years old and older. But we had a few questions from folks who were still confused about this. For instance, some people asked us, what's the difference between, say, a 15-year-old who weighs the same as an adult woman? What physiologically is the difference?
So there are a few things. One is that we always want to have data from the population in which we're administering the vaccine. So adolescents, just because they weigh the same, it might be bigger than mm-hmm. you know, a 15-year-old boy might be bigger than a 25-year-old woman, potentially. But their metabolism is different, and their immune response may be different. In fact, sometimes children's immune responses are actually can be more vigorous than adults. So one thing just to say is that about children in general, because I know this is a question that many people have, Pfizer and Moderna are both doing studies in children, conducting studies in children. They are going gradually down in age. They want really to assess if the vaccines are safe in these ages, and they, in some cases they're also going down in dose. They also want to look at the immune response in these children. So those studies are proceeding. Pfizer has actually, I believe, completed their study in the 12 to 16-year age group and will be over time submit. They've completed enrollment, and they will be submitting those data to the FDA, and they will continue to move down in age.
This is from Jessica of Tucson, Arizona, and she asks, is there any correlation between the strength of an individual's immune system and the intensity of their response to the vaccine?
So what I would say, I think the very good news, we don't have one specific measure where we can look at the strength of an individual immune system. But what we do know about these vaccines, which is wonderful and very reassuring, is that they work across a very wide age spectrum. And that's very reassuring because we do have some vaccines that, for example, don't work as well in the elderly or don't work as well in people with those conditions. So we can say that they really work very well across a range of people with different kinds of immune responses.
Passover starts on March 27th. And it's generally celebrated with family and friends. After receiving both doses of the vaccine for Passover, we have a listener, Linda Bloomstein of West Bloomfield, Michigan, who wants to know if she can still get together with her family. Dr. Ruth, I'm sure a lot of people are making this calculation as they become fully inoculated. What do you recommend they do?
So I think I do get these kinds of questions, variations on this question very often. And I may disappoint people because I won't give them a simple yes or no answer. And what I would say is that vaccinated people should be thinking about, number one, protection of themselves, number two, protection of their loved ones, and number three, protection of society. And so some of the questions as people are thinking about whether they're going to get together with others who might even be vaccinated is, one, are the people that I'm planning to gather with vaccinated? And is everyone in their household vaccinated? So you might be getting together with another vaccinated couple, but they've come from their house where they have three other unvaccinated individuals. And could you potentially transmit to them and then have them transmit to unvaccinated household members? And then the last question, of course, is what kind of travel is involved? And I would say that people really need to conform to their state's regulations around that. So meaning, I know in my state of Maryland, if you travel outside of the state or outside of our area, you need to either provide a negative COVID test or quarantine for 10 days when you come back still. So it's important to follow those rules. Those are the kinds of things that I think people should be thinking about and asking themselves and asking of the people that they want to gather with.
Dr. Ruth Caron is a professor of international health in the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins. She's also the director of the Center for Immunization Research. And we will try to answer a few more of your questions. You can find those answers at hereandnow.org. Dr. Ruth Caron, thank you so much for taking the time to answer some of our listener questions.
Thank you so much, Tanya.
It's been 1 year since destructive tornadoes ripped through Nashville and other parts of Middle Tennessee, killing more than 20 people. With the need to rebuild came concerns about developers using the opportunity to further gentrify the historically black North Nashville neighborhood. Some residents feared their neighbors would be enticed by a flood of offers to leave. But as Damon Mitchell of member station WPLN reports, some homeowners decided to stay and rebuild.
In the immediate aftermath, Ivan Boggs never considered leaving North Nashville. I first met him as he was clearing debris from the outside of his home.
1 minute it's there and the next minute just gone.
And did you all have time to think? What did you all do?
It happened so fast, all I could do was go to the ground.
The tornado spun through Boggs' block, destroying some homes and cars while leaving others hardly touched. Months later, I revisited him at his home, which he's owned for 17 years. From his living room, he glanced out the window and described the damage house by house.
The one next to Mr. Steve is remodeling. You know, it was there. It was just sucked out. Everything was sucked out through the tornado. It just was gutted.
Boggs has since finished rebuilding his home. He says several of his friends and longtime neighbors also held on to their properties. But that isn't to say he hasn't noticed new changes.
As I see on 16th, all the newer and bigger homes over on 16th, those, I feel like the landlord sold the property.
North Nashville was one of several hard-hit neighborhoods after the tornado tore apart hundreds of homes and businesses. But even before the storm, the area was already attracting developers. That raised concerns that residents would sell off their damaged homes. As a result, the Equity Alliance and other community groups led homeowner education and door-knocking campaigns, including Don't Sell Out the North, to get people to stay.
For some of those properties, which normally would have not sold if it had not been a storm, I'm definitely sure that there's a case there for some of those properties, no doubt.
That's Vivian Wilhoit. She's Nashville's property assessor. Wilhoit says she's aware of how much gentrification has affected the area, but also points out that in 2020, she didn't see an immediate increase in home sales in the damaged 37208 zip code. That includes tornado-damaged North Nashville and Germantown.
In the prior year, The number of properties that sold that were residential was 231. So in 2019, it was higher than the year of the March tornado.
Her numbers show about 50 fewer sales happened in the storm year. Homeowners like Mimi Graham, whose house was damaged just a mile away from Ivan Boggs, says the area had already been swamped with new development. So there isn't much left to protect from gentrification.
Yeah, it was changing before the tornado hit. Like, they were putting up all these different type of houses, and they didn't match the houses that are here.
Graham was born and raised in the community. She says she didn't want to leave just because things were changing around her.
My dad worked hard, and he bought this home. He came from Alabama, and you know how rough it was in Alabama for him. So that's why he moved to Nashville, to make a better life for himself and his family.
Graham is one of many homeowners who've been assisted through Nashville's Tornado Recovery Group. It's run by nonprofit Community Foundation of Middle Tennessee. That's the largest organizer for tornado recovery. They've given more than $6 million to frontline nonprofits that are helping with the rebuild. The funds are allowing Graham to repair her home, which is still under construction a year after the tornado. I popped in on a construction worker to see the progress in November.
This is going to be one big open room. And this right here is the center part of the house. This is coming completely out to where it's open to the kitchen.
For Graham, rebuilding her home is a way of preserving her father's work after he moved to the neighborhood. For years before and after the storm, Graham has been getting phone calls, emails, and text messages to sell. But she says there's pride in having a legacy that's from the area.
It's just the north side. It's like our territory, our hood.
Graham says she won't be pushed out by tornadoes or gentrification. And in the future, her home would be passed down to younger family members. For Here and Now, I'm Damon Mitchell.
You can find us on Twitter at Here and Now. I'm Tanya Mosley, at Tanya Mosley. Robin Young is at Here and Now Robin. Peter O'Dowd is at O'Dowd Peter.
And I'm at Callum Borchers. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Callum Borchers.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now.